You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike
for president.
Add Ike to you, add me to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, 'cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Good evening. My name is Michelle Bartlett, and I'm so glad to see all of you here. Would you believe that 2 weeks ago we had sold 20 tickets? Okay. I said today, all the seats, and we will fill them. So I've won the bet tonight. Okay, this is good. This is very good. Because it's Fairbanks, it's a Friday night, and the weather looks good, and you're inside. And you know that in Fairbanks, all the TV ads have been bought for the season, and I know people have been hitting the mute button. So tonight is a time to laugh. Tonight is a time to poke fun. And I know that Neil and Ken have a wonderful show for us, and I want to do a special thank you to KUAC and Lori Neufeld, who interviewed them. But without further ado, Ken and our friend, Neil, this is your show.
Good evening, I'm Neil Conan. Here's your script part.
And I'm Ken Rudin. You know, as Michelle said, I mean, everybody knows Neil Conan, and even I know Neil Conan, but for 78 years, we were partners every Wednesday on Talk of the Nation, that we would do this political junkie show that became the most popular segment on NPR. And what we would do is we would talk about the politics of the day, or the politics of the week. We'd had interviewed lawmakers and journalists and academics, but we would make politics fun. We never made it snarky. We weren't opinionated.
Speak for yourself.
Well, except for those right-wing and left-wing loonies, but you know about them. But we just love the politics. I know a lot of people compare politics and sports, and obviously politics is much more consequential, but we look at it the same way in the sense that there's lore, there's trivia, there's stories, and it's about people. As bad as things are in Washington, and they are bad, we still remember times when they were good, and we have hopes that they will.
It was a Tuesday, I think, at about 11:30 in the morning.
I remember that day. But anyway, the point is, we're here to have fun. We're here to talk politics, but we can do politics and have fun at the same time, and you'll be the judge of that, I guess.
But before we get to that, Ken, this is your first time in Alaska.
It's my first time in Alaska. I've been to... Yes, I'm very excited. I mean, I'm very excited. I mean, I haven't followed politics in a long time, but I'm very excited to meet Governor Egan, and it'll be really great to be here and everything like that. But my wife and I are here. We're here for a full week. We're going to see Denali and Seward and Anchorage, and I know there's no place like Nome. But if I use
3 minutes.
Well, we only had 7 jokes on Talk of the Nation. We use them all the time. But it's going to be a great time tonight. I'd love to learn. I'd love to share what we see, as we see national politics, as we see what's going on or not going on in Congress, and what's going on in the lead up to the 2016 presidential race.
Before we get on to the show proper, we wanted to thank a couple of people who made this possible. Of course, Michelle Bartlett, and of course, the invaluable assistance from Charu Upal of the Summer Sessions UAF office. And we have to thank our friends at KUAC also.
Absolutely. Lori Neufeld.
But Ken, you mentioned history. Alaska's got a lot of political history.
It does. I mean, you know, I mean, I guess you guys are inundated. As a matter of fact, Alaska has seen more ads in the Senate race in 2014 than any other state. And so you may be tired of it already, even though it's only July. But the point is, it is consequential. It is significant. The Republicans, as you've been told over and over again, they need 6 seats, a net gain of 6 seats to take control of the Senate. Alaska has been on the list from the moment Mark Begich was elected in 2008 because, well, if Ted Stevens wasn't indicted and convicted, what if President Obama and the Democrats didn't have this get-out-the-vote effort in 2008, we may have been looking at a completely different dynamic here. But it's one of those states that Mitt Romney carried in 2012, where if you look at Arkansas and Louisiana and North Carolina and South Dakota and West Virginia and Montana, that's a beaut. Yeah. And is this on? And Alaska as well. So, I mean, these are key states. You guys may be inundated with it and bored to tears, but it is very, very exciting and, as I said, very consequential.
We'll have more about, a lot more about the Alaska Senate race a little bit later in the show. But there's been a lot else that's happened this week. Speaker of the House, John Boehner, is suing the President of the United States.
Well, he says it's because of executive action. And I think Obama sued Boehner for legislative inaction. I think it was a bad thing. But you know what this is really about? This is really about, in my view, it's not so much a reckless Republican gamble to satisfy the right wing. It is to fend off Republicans who are seriously talking about impeaching the president. When Sarah Palin announced that it's time to impeach the president, I must have gotten 50 emails from Democrats, from Democratic groups saying, well, Sarah Palin is saying this, and the other Republicans are saying no. John Boehner is in one of those precarious positions where he has the Tea Party pulling him on the right, but at the same time, he wouldn't be Speaker John Boehner if it wasn't for the Tea Party in 2010. So he knows what got him in the speakership. He knows what got the Republicans in the majority. But at the same time, he also wants to get things done. So,
and if he didn't know, all he had to do was look at his former majority leader.
Exactly, Eric Cantor. I mean, everybody knows about David Bratt, the unknown guy who defeated Eric Cantor in the primary a few weeks ago. When I saw the headline, Bratt upsets Cantor, I thought it was a story about a precocious bar mitzvah kid. I mean, I didn't know what it meant. Maybe not. But I mean, Eric Cantor spent $5 million on the campaign. David Bratt only had $200,000.
Yes.
But I understand that the challenges, it was backed by Rob Lowe. they backed his pack. It was the Bratt pack.
The Bratt pack.
Jokes never to use again. in the audience.
Okay.
What's fascinating to me, and I think it's a big fault of the media, this obsession of giving scorecards every week. The Tea Party is up, it's down, it's sideways, it's inside out. It's so simplistic to look at it that way. Every state is different. Every electorate is different. We watched what happened to Thad Cochran in Mississippi, and everybody says, well, the Tea Party lost because they wanted Thad Cochran beaten. But Thad Cochran won it in a very unusual way. The usual tactic of having African Americans vote in Republican primaries.
Exactly. Yes, right.
So there are a lot of different situations, and you know, I think it's very lazy of us, the media, to have these Tea Parties up, Tea Parties down. The point is, we need to see what the people are talking about, what they care about, the issues they care about, and for many of them, in many states, the issues are pretty much the same.
The media is talking a lot this week about Hillary's up, Hillary's down. Second week of the book tour, not going so well.
I know everybody likes to get on the bash Hillary bandwagon, and I understand that. Look, it just seems like she seems a little rusty. When she talks about that we were dead broke when we left the White House in 2009, and in the next couple of years, Bill Clinton made $109 million in speeches.
I was dead broke when I left Talk of the Nation last June, and I'm still waiting for my $109 million.
Well, thank God for KUAC. They made up the difference.
Oh, absolutely.
But I mean, it just, you know, this just, and then she'll say things like, unlike the really rich, I mean, look, Republicans are not going to be able to attack Hillary Clinton for her close ties to the Wall Street or the banking industry or the money interests. But there is a progressive left out there, perhaps embodied by Elizabeth Warren, who says, wait a second, we hated the 8 years of George W. Bush. We were disappointed with some of the Obama thing on Guantanamo and things that were promised that were not delivered on. And so I don't know if Elizabeth Warren is there to tell Hillary Clinton that you can't veer too much to the center. And especially on foreign policy, she's a hawk on foreign policy. She's certainly talking about more aggressive foreign policy in Syria, in Iraq. And I mean, my goodness, what's going on there? It's almost impossible to say what should be done and what should not be done. But for all the talk about internecine Republican rivalries and warfare, the Democrats, while I still think Hillary Clinton is the clear frontrunner, the clear nominee for 2016, the Democrats have some things to talk about as well.
You mentioned Iraq, but the news of the week from the foreign news is Israel and Hamas going at it again in the Gaza Strip, rockets firing into Israel, and a lot of bombing and a lot of civilian deaths in Gaza.
You knew this was going to happen. When the three Israeli teenagers who were hitchhiking were abducted and killed, you knew that bad things were about to happen.
The president went down to Texas this week, a big triumph was apparently getting Rick Perry to come out of the tarmac to shake his hand. But there's no agreement between Republicans and Democrats about what to do next, even though it's reported that both sides agree on what to do next in terms of changing the law that has underage immigrants from Central American countries treated differently from underage immigrants from Mexico.
Well, yes, and that's been the policy, I think, that was signed in the waning months of the Bush administration
and took
effect in early 2009. But at the same time, and this is something that President Obama and Speaker Boehner said from the beginning, the Republicans looked at the 2012 presidential election. They see that 78% of Latino vote is voting for Democrats. It's a thing that the Democrats like to hang around the Republicans' neck. Boehner says, if we're going to forget about what's going on right now, because most Republican members of Congress do not have sizable minority Latino members in their districts, but demographics are changing. Texas in 2014, Georgia in 2014 are not going to be the same states.
Arizona,
because I have a sense of humor. And
I can't believe I set him up for that.
I have four more jokes and that's it. But I'm saying that you would think that after you saw the results of 2012, something might change, but this is a sizable contingent in the Republican Party.
Again, ask Eric Cantor.
Well, I don't think Eric Cantor really lost for that reason. There's a lot of reasons Eric Cantor lost, but it did send a signal to many Republicans that if we're going to, maybe we're jeopardizing our future. If we're going to talk about immigration overhaul, if we're going to talk to President Obama, we have to worry about a conservative challenge from the right.
Interesting decision by a judge, federal judge in Florida, demanding that the legislature's redistricting of two congressional districts in that state was unconstitutional, demanding that they redraw those districts. Obviously, that's not going to take effect for this run of up in 2014, but it's causing some squealing on both sides.
Whatever you think about the way politics is run in Washington and in the country, it is almost unforgivable the way that lines are drawn for Congress. And it's not a Republican thing. The Democrats do it, too.
Particularly here in Alaska.
Yeah, all those congressional seats. I know, exactly. Does Don Young move?
No, it's
one seat. No, but of course, you've had, I know there are serious redistricting issues in the state legislature here as well.
Yeah.
But around the country, whoever's in charge, I mean, we talk about, we in Washington are obsessed with the elections for Senate and the House, but gubernatorial elections, it's very important to know who the next governor is, of course, at all times, and the state legislature as well. And so we don't pay enough attention to that, but clearly whoever controls the game controls the lines.
And this is done in every state where one party has predominant power. You saw it in Ohio with the Republicans, in Maryland with the Democrats.
And Illinois with the Democrats, yes. But there are some states like Iowa, like Arizona, they have nonpartisan commissions that draw the lines. And in California, they have also a nonpartisan redistricting. Now, if you go into politics, you really go into politics to help your side win. So not many politicians want to give up the power they have. Mm. But ultimately, it just disenfranchises many people. In North Carolina, for example, I think the Republicans control 9 out of the 12 congressional seats, but the Democrats got a million more votes in the state. Now, it's like a World Series game. 1960.
Yes, don't remind me about 1960.
The Yankees and the Pirates. The Yankees scored far more runs, but the name of the game is winning four games. Pirates won four. They won the World Series. The Republicans won two.
Bill Mazeroski, may you rot in hell.
But I'm just saying, I mean, that's the way the game is played. But sometimes when we see fewer and fewer people coming out to vote because the lines are rigged, because the game is rigged, maybe things will change. Maybe.
Those two districts, by the way, Corinne Brown, the Democrat, and Daniel Webster, the Republican. Who knew Daniel Webster was still in Congress? Moved to Florida, became a Republican, but was still in Congress.
Now, everybody that age moves to Florida.
That's exactly right. Yeah. But speaking of people sometimes getting disinterested in their office, but Ray Nagin, the mayor, former mayor of New Orleans, apparently interested enough in his second term, according to his critics, to pack away a lot of patronage for his family business. Convicted and sentenced this week to 10 years in prison.
You know, we always talk, one of the things that got the Democrats elected to the House majority in 2006 was Nancy Pelosi talking about the culture of corruption, and we knew about the Jack Abramoff scandal and things like that, but both sides have been caught. Charlie Rangel in New York, of course, he doesn't pay the price because he's, I mean, he was first elected in 1066. I looked that up. And yet he still wins, and so yeah, I think they'll have to carry him out, but both sides play the game, and sometimes they get caught and sometimes they don't.
Well, we promised you more about the Alaska Senate race and more about Alaska politics. To help us along, we've invited a distinguished panel of journalists to join us here. Let me introduce them. Alexandra Gutierrez, who covers the State House and politics for the Alaska Public Radio Network. Dermot Cole, who's now with the Alaska Dispatch News, formerly a columnist with the Fairbanks Daily News Miner, and Tom Hewitt, opinion editor of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Let's welcome them to the stage. Let me begin, and Dermot is the person who brings a more historical perspective, perhaps, to this than the rest of your panel. How do you gauge this Senate race? Does Mark Begich have a chance?
Mark Begich has a chance, but he's got a difficult situation because, as you mentioned, his election to the Senate came under what we might call peculiar circumstances. Ted Stevens was indicted a month before the primary election, and Ted Stevens demanded that he have a trial before the election, which he didn't expect to be convicted, but he was.
And it was later overturned, we have to point out.
It was later overturned, but he almost won, despite his conviction.
On election night, he was ahead by 2,000. It wasn't until later in November. Part of that, by the way, was the Obama campaign never thinking they could win Alaska, but they got enough people on the ground to get that Democratic vote out.
That's definitely true. And again, this doesn't necessarily replay for Begich, but Begich has won before as mayor of Anchorage, where he shouldn't have won. If he has reason for hope, it may be there. And secondarily, it may be if Joe Miller loses the Republican primary and runs as an independent.
Well, Alexandra, let me ask you. There's got to be an opponent. It is yet to be decided. And among the candidates, Joe Miller, but he, as Dermot just suggested, maybe not the front runner this time around.
Not exactly this time. He's had the lowest approval ratings in every poll, inside, outside, every which way. He's definitely got a...
Now.
A core following. I mean, you know, you'll see Joe Miller signs everywhere along the Glenn Highway, Richardson Highway out here. But what Dermot was talking about is there is the potential for him to run as a third-party candidate at the state Republican convention. Couple of months ago, we had the three candidates come on, and the big question that everyone wanted to know is, if you do not win the primary, will you support the presumptive winner? And it was all kumbaya. We had Dan Sullivan, who's raised the most money, Mead Treadwell, who's had the most experience in state politics, all say, yeah, of course we're going to get behind each other. And then Joe Miller comes up and says, you haven't given me a reason to trust you. You haven't backed me in the past. There needs to be a basis of trust. He's since kind of waffled on this, said, I never really meant that, with a piece in Politico down the road. But there's been some speculation that
he must be embarrassed when people say he might pull a Murkowski.
but in fairness, why should Joe Miller promise not to run as a third party or an independent when he wasn't afforded the same opportunity in 2010?
Well, he thinks that there's some poetic justice to it, I think. There's definitely a lot of animosity from him towards the Murkowski camp and the people who supported her, and he counts Treadwell and Dan Sullivan among those members.
So as we go along in this race, Tom Hewitt, is Sullivan the presumptive candidate?
He's certainly running like the front runner right now. In fact, in a lot of things, he's basically running as though he and Mark Begich are the only ones in the race. Basically, all of his attacks have gone directly towards Mark Begich and not, to a very much lesser extent to his opponents. And when he drafted his Alaska agreement that would have had both he and Mark Begich sign on to try and remove third-party PAC money from, ads that will run between now and the election, he made no mention of his opponents. And so he's essentially running like it's a two-candidate race, and he occasionally has to be reminded from Mead Treadwell and, by Joe Miller that they are indeed still planning on running in the primary.
I've been up here a week, but the TV in our cabin only gets over-the-air television, so I've only seen ads for Mark Begich and Dan Sullivan, and they've all been very positive. A, am I missing something? And B...
Yes, you are. but you may not be missing a lot. If you're missing something.
Well, see, we only get the Pornos channel in my place, so I haven't seen any of the ads. But
Only get or only watch.
But I was going to ask you, though, how significant the split in the party in 2010 between Senator Murkowski and Joe Miller, how does that still resonate in 2014?
I think it certainly does for Joe Miller. In many ways, he's running the same campaign now that he ran in 2010.
I understand he's using some of the same campaign signs.
Well, he's a conservative. But the real story of that race, though, I think, was that Lisa Murkowski had no clue that she was going to lose the primary, and did not. She was saving her money for the general election, so she did not really run a strenuous campaign. Let's say
it was a gun. It was a referendum on the ballot that basically brought out the Miller
abortion.
Oh, it was abortion.
It was abortion, parental notification initiative, right. And that was something that, you know, in the churches, Joe had really aligned himself with this issue, and a lot of the people who were working on the abortion initiative were coming out to vote for that, and specifically, as everyone probably in this room remembers, it was basically a 2-point margin between Miller and Murkowski, and yeah, the initiative probably made a difference.
And the Sarah Palin endorsement, I mean, everybody rolls their eyes with Sarah Palin in 2014, but in 2010, even though as a former governor, she still played an outsized role in the party.
It's hard to remember
debatable.
That. For somebody my age, it's hard to remember back that far, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure in Alaska that she...
I think here, at least, I mean, by then her star was already on the wane. And I think in large part that had to do with her decision to step down from the governorship. A lot of people here saw that as basically quitting on the job. And that's, you know, not something that Alaskans take kindly to, whether, you know, it's actively, you know, saying I'm done with this job or just kind of saying, oh, well, I'm just going to sit on my laurels for the rest of my term.
Yeah, I remember at the time the only place her approval numbers were lower was Massachusetts.
You mentioned the ballot measure that brought people out last time. There's a measure on the ballot this time. And Alexandra, let me ask you. One side said, it's our oil, and the other side says, it's our oil. I'm glad they agree.
Yeah. Well, so the oil and tax initiative you're talking about, it's a referendum. It's on the August ballot.
Because this is to seek to overturn a law that was passed,
right.
So it has to be on the next election, which is the primary.
There are complicated rules in our Constitution as to when an initiative can appear on the ballot, depending on when the legislature gavels out. So initially we were going to have a marijuana initiative, minimum wage initiative, an initiative that would slow down the development of Pebble Mine, which has been a very controversial issue in the state, and the oil tax referendum all on the August ballot. But then we saw the legislature go a few days late, which pushed everything but the oil tax referendum to November. So,
does this happenstance, do you think?
it depends on who you talk to. You're going to have two representatives later, and you can ask them their opinions.
And has anybody figured out what this argument is about?
The oil tax referendum? I kind of feel bad for voters who are going to be trying to make sense of this their first time by reading this question. You know, people are fairly fluent, I like to think, in our oil tax policy just because it funds so much of state government. But it's still a complicated measure. And what people really want to know is, okay, how much money is the state going to get out of this? How much longer are our oil fields going to be in production? And one of the big problems is so much of the information on how these tax regimes have worked is confidential information from the oil companies. And then on top of it, a lot of the information you get is from the governor, from DNR, and the oil companies, who all have an interest in seeing this new tax regime stay in place.
And that actually is a little bit tricky for, you know, folks who are voting this fall, is that a yes vote is a vote to get rid of
the law,
law, and a no vote is a vote to, you know, basically keep the law that we have, which is a little counterintuitive. But it's correct that generally, you know, folks who lean left are saying, you know, it's our oil, let's go back to the tax system that we had. And the folks who lean right and you know, business interests, corporate interests, that sort of thing, are tending to say, you know, no, this new system, you know, will work. And really what it comes down to is, you know, a very simple phrase that, you know, is in our state constitution about how the state should use the resources of the state for the maximum benefit of its people. And the question is, what does maximum benefit mean? You know, does it mean that we should try and continue to enjoy our revenues at their current status for as long as possible, or should we try and draw out, you know, our resources so that maybe the end of the Prudhoe Bay oil comes at, you know, 60 years out instead of 40, and we're going to have that big falling off of the cliff for our state revenue?
It reminds me of the old Chicago slogan, vote oily, vote often. Right, exactly.
There's a lot of that here.
One more thing about Mark Begich. I mean, obviously, he's a Democrat, and President Obama is a Democrat, and President Obama's numbers are not great anywhere, especially in red states like Alaska. Do the voters of Alaska see him as just part of the Democratic line, or do they see him as an independent standing up to Obama? And does it matter?
It matters a lot, I think. And I think that is largely what the fall election will be run on, is how much can he be tied to the Obama administration, because Obama is unpopular across the state. And, you know, Obama lost the state in 2008. He lost it in 2012. And I mean, if he were running in 2014, he'd lose again. and so, you know, what you see from the Republican opponents of Obama, especially from Dan Sullivan, is, you know, this line that he votes with, you know, Obama's policies 97% of the time, which, you know, it's one of those numbers where you can kind of count it one way or count it another way. From his side, you know, what they're, you know, the number they're touting is that he votes the party line fewer than 44 other senators in the Senate in his party. So, I mean, he is one of the most independent Democrats, although he's still, I mean, that still means he votes with the party 80-some percent of the time.
Dermot, let me ask you, this time around we are also seeing another run by one of the most vivid politicians in the country, and that is your congressman, Don Young. You wrote a column a couple of weeks ago about I guess, shenanigans in the United States Congress, and described him as an embarrassment.
Well, yes, I did. I was upset watching this clip from C-SPAN in which Congressman Young walked onto the Senate floor, or the House floor, and did this.
All of us have wanted to do that on the House floor.
Which is fine. I would have not.
By the way, we're rebroadcasting this on radio. Can you do that face again for radio?
Right. Well, maybe you guys could try that. You're experienced this. Well, okay, so Don, what he did was he stuck his thumbs in his ears, waved his fingers, and stuck out his tongue. Now, the reason it was a problem as far as I was concerned, because at the very moment there was a bill up to dedicate a post office in memory of a soldier who died in Afghanistan. And I think he should have been paying attention. He should have. He should have called that family and apologized. And it was an embarrassment to the people of Alaska. Yeah, I've got nothing against Don Young personally. I've known him for 40 years. But this was this I didn't think was acceptable behavior.
You know, he is the most senior Republican in the House, and he's been there for, as you know, since 1973. What fascinates me about Don Young is sometimes he'll win by the narrowest of margins, and other times he'll win by 70%. Does he get unpopular sometimes and popular sometimes? Or I mean, it's the same Don Young.
He's a remarkable running machine. He's run, I think, 20 times at least. Generally, the Democrats have put up a weak opponent.
Token resistance, I think, yes.
There have been
sacrificial lamb.
There have been several instances to the contrary. John Devens was a very strong candidate, but that was a long time ago. Well, the closest that someone came to defeating Don Young was Sean Parnell.
Sean Parnell, right. In
the primary. In the primary.
He is
a unique individual, as you said.
For some years now, it seems like what Democrats in the state will do is, you know, when a Democratic representative or senator in the state legislature is looking to end their political career, but not do so just by retiring, right, they'll run against Don Young. I guess it's worked well for them as a retirement plan, but it's been a long time, and it may very well continue to be so. Although, I mean, as he kind of, you know, gets up in years and occasionally does things like Dermot was talking about, or you know, making insensitive remarks about, you know, people of various ethnicities, it's who knows when his number might be up.
I wanted to ask you, it's been described that one source of his political strength is his support in Native villages. And how much of a factor is that? Because we read in places that cover Alaska closely, like the New York Times, that both parties are now working hard to organize votes in Native villages.
In some races, that's been a key support for him, yes. Because his late wife was a native Alaskan, and that has helped him.
Mm-hmm. And more generally, I mean, the native vote in Alaska is crucial, both because, you know, there are large numbers of natives who vote, and also because they tend to vote, you know, based on key people within their community, and so, you know, they will vote largely as a block. It's no secret that it was the native vote that delivered the state for Lisa Murkowski in 2010 when she was running her
campaign. Does the native peoples predominantly vote D or R, or is it, as
or it
you
just
say,
depends?
It just depends.
Well, it can often be interesting looking at the Alaska political map after your usual election, because we're one of the few states that when you blow us up and you go red, blue by district, all of the red is in the urban areas, and then it'll be in a giant field of blue, kind of contrary to the rest of the United States, where it's blue in the urban areas and then red in all of the rural areas.
Except 2/3 of the population is in the greater Anchorage area, and that's controlling the state.
We're going to have you on later to talk about national politics, but one more question before you go now. Is there a race for governor?
Well, so long as it's a three-way race, right now we've got Sean Parnell, the Republican incumbent, Bill Walker, an independent candidate who challenged Parnell in 2010 as a Republican, but lost in the primary. And then we have Byron Mallott running as a Democrat. Right now, both Mallott and Walker have been running against Parnell, and when you have two people running against a governor who's going to get, you know, at least about 40% no matter what, that doesn't really leave you winning a three-way race. So there's been some tension between the two campaigns that are challenging Parnell, suggesting, oh, well, if I were running alone, I would be a credible candidate.
Dermot Cole, Alexandra Gutierrez, and Tom Hewitt, thanks very much. Again, we're going to have you back
Thank
later.
You.
One of the most popular segments on Political Junkie was Ken's trivia question, and he's got some. Do you have any Alaska trivia questions?
No.
No.
Okay. I do. Is it time for trivia?
It is time for trivia.
Well, okay. Don't call out the answer, and just raise your hand, and I will call on you. I'll start off with the easiest one, and then there'll be a little more hard. We know that Lisa Murkowski and Mike Gravel are the last two Alaska senators to be defeated in the primaries, right? Who was the last governor to lose in the primary? Right here.
Frank Murkowski.
Frank Murkowski is correct. So you get...
There you go.
Neil, get $2 for the button. Here's a little tougher one. Now, they are going to get significantly tougher, and if you can't get them, too bad. Okay. Before Sarah Palin, who was the last former mayor to run for vice president on a major party ticket? Before Sarah Palin, the last former mayor, of course she was mayor of Wasilla, who was the last former mayor to run for vice president?
Crickets. Here's a quick.
Hubert Humphrey is the correct answer. Hubert Humphrey in 1964 was a senator from Minnesota, but he was the former mayor of Minneapolis. Okay. Before Lisa Murkowski, who was the last senator elected on a write-in campaign? Yes, and then? Strom Thurmond is correct.
Wow.
What's amazing about Strom, I mean, I don't know if you remember this the tragic case in Missouri in 2000 when Mel Carnahan was campaigning for election to the Senate, and he perished in a plane crash. And he still beat John Ashcroft. Do you remember that? But, and I looked this up. He was the first posthumously elected senator since Strom Thurmond, which is kind of remarkable. Okay. I told you, no more Republican jokes. Okay. Who was the only Alaska senator to be elected after two previous defeats for that office? The only Alaska senator to be defeated after two unsuccessful runs for the Senate. Need hands. Yes. Ted Stevens is the correct answer.
Ah.
defeated by Ernest Greening in 1962, and then in 1968, he lost the Republican primary to Elmer Rasmussen. And then after Bob Bartlett died, Governor Hickel appointed him to the Senate. By the way, I know this stuff. And the final question is, this is the most ridiculous of all of them. I'm going to call up a congressman or a House member. Who was the last Alaska congressman, member of the House, to be defeated for re-election? Wow, this is a tough one. This is the hardest one of all. Who? I'll give you Ralph Rivers. That is the correct answer. Ralph Rivers was defeated in 1966 by Howard Pollack. Pollack gave up the seat to run for governor in 1970. Nick Begich won the seat in 70, perished in 72, but was reelected, and then Don Young has held it ever since. And those are the trivia questions.
Great job.
Oh, yes. Okay, now we are fortunate to have two members of the state legislature here to talk about the state legislature and their goings-on. First, we have Doug Isaacson. He was elected to the North Pole Council in 2000. He was elected mayor in 2006. He's been in, he's not a true Alaskan. He's only been here since 1977, 79, thereabouts. But he served in the U.S. Air Force. He's been in the legislature since, as I say, since 2012. And we have Doug Isaacson, the Republican.
So am I the token Republican?
Would you take the seat to the far right?
And to my far left, David Guttenberg is the former chairman of the Alaska Democratic Party. He's been in the state legislature since 2003. In 2004, he defeated a guy named Joe Miller. And is prepared for re-election. Here's David Guttenberg. So I think the first question is, I've talked to you both separately. Why do you both dislike each other?
Because he has hair and looks like Mark Twain. And I'm envious.
That's it.
Doug, in Washington, we're obsessed with the family feud between the Tea Party and establishment Republicans. Do those chasms exist in the Republican caucus in Juneau?
The internecine?
Internecine, yes.
Internecine type divisions. You know, we have a majority caucus that is actually made up of urban Republicans and rural Democrats.
That's something.
And so there is a lot of diversity within that concept, but we're all committed to certain key principles, strong, healthy families, strong communities. We wanted to do some education reform. We definitely wanted to do oil reform, oil tax reform, and energy. We wanted to make sure that we brought affordable energy to Alaskans, and we're still working on that. But we made significant steps.
Do you mean natural gas? Is that
natural gas? Or I was co-chair of House Energy, and one of the things that we can do is restructure our utility delivery and generation and transmission. And there's $1 billion worth of work to be done that's been identified. And sometimes we always wait for the state to do it when we could have private enterprise. So how can we bring down the cost to our residents and our businesses without necessarily waiting for the government to do it?
I wanted to ask you both. One of the things that distinguishes Alaska from any other place in the country is the amount of wilderness, of wild land. And those of us who live in the rest of the country look with awe at the kinds of resources that are available in places that don't have much population or any population, the huge national parks, the huge state parks. But there's this tension with development that you're talking about. And I'm wondering, could I ask you both, for example, the Ambler Road project, which is to run along the southern boundaries of the Gates of the Arctic National Park out to mines near the village of Kobuk. This is going to be in a previously pristine area. Is this something that is under debate? Is this relationship with the wilderness under debate? Does the wilderness have an advocate?
I'll let you go for the advocate side, and then because I could talk for hours on this, and part of it.
Well, we've just only got a little time.
So I'll keep it real short. One of the things that we have to keep in mind again is the settlement of the land, and the resource development, and how do we do that? So if we just had 1/10 of our mineral resources, which we rank among the top 10 among nations of the world. In our resources, and yet we're in the bottom 5% of exporting and manufacturing and
if
so
you
forth,
were in
of states of states in the United States. So if we look at just 1/10 of our resources put into production, we would have $18 billion in revenue from the various taxes, royalty, and corporate, and so forth, which would eclipse what we make in oil. We could replace a lot of what we did, and we'd provide jobs for everyone. We'd have energy corridors and so forth. There is some debate. I'll let you talk about the debate.
Well, it clearly is a divisive issue, where the road goes, who lives there and how they feel about it, and who are we doing it for. And you're right, it is pristine, and there are a lot of people in the country that have a sense of Alaska's the last place, and if you're going to do anything, you better do it right. We have a history of not doing it right. We walk all over a lot of things in a sense, and you know the example that Doug gave about resource development, you know, and bringing down the cost of energy and delivering energy to the state. And, you know, with all the Republican leadership all these years, we still don't have it. We're still dividing on it. We're still paying a lot of money for a lot of things. The road to Ambler, the people up there are very concerned about the nature of what's going to change in their communities. The industry wants it. Who should build it is part of the problem. Who has access to it is another part of the problem. You know, in many places, like you go back to Pennsylvania, you know, people want to hunt, and the deer are plentiful, the natural resources are plentiful. You go up on the Kobuk or on the south side of the Brooks Range, and you're looking for moose, and there's not a lot of them, or caribou. There's not a lot of them. But those folks out there want jobs.
Sure.
There's no doubt about it. Those economies in my western part of the district, oil is $8 or $10 a gallon. Gas is more expensive. Fuel is flown in a good part of the year. There is no cash economy. There are no jobs, and that is a critical part. But in the sense that they're hungry for jobs, they're hungry for a sustainable economy, they're also concerned about their culture.
That is part of the dialogue. But it isn't just the fact that we have done it wrong. We haven't done it wrong. Red Dog up in the Nana area of western Alaska has done it right. The soil used to be very acidic. It would leach out a lot of toxins, and because of the mine, they've purified the water. It's a much better watershed. There's fish there, actually. Usabelli coal mine right here, or Pogo down by Delta, or Fort Knox here. We do mining right, and the water comes out better. The land is revegetated. You can't even tell that Usabelli mines coal right outside of a large national park, the Denali National Park.
I was lucky enough to go on a float on the Kobuk last year. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. But I also noticed the name of one of the features right alongside where the road is projected to run. It's called Mount Asbestos. I don't think they were joking. I don't think it's a metaphor.
And a lot of these are natural occurring metals, and we're rich in these type of resources, again, and they have their purpose. But people forget they're in the ground, and they come out, whether or not man is there. And when man manages his resources, or women, mankind, when we manage our resources, we make things better. Ever heard of a farm in the Midwest that was productive without management? You cultivate something, you get more productivity, you employ more people, you create the economy that allows someone to be out in a rural area.
Doug, let me. This is a philosophical question that, when I think of Alaska being so far away from Alaska, I think of it as a state that desperately needs the largesse or the support from the federal government. And yet, from a lot of what I've heard you say and what I've heard a lot of people say, but they resent the interference of the federal government, the intrusion of the federal government. Can you have one without the other? Cake and eat it kind of thing?
At this moment, the interior, for example, interior Alaska is supported 70% of its payroll is direct or indirectly government. So at this moment, we could not stand alone. But at statehood, the whole debate was whether or not Alaska could stand on its own. And so the resources of Alaska were written up in its constitution much differently than any other state, where the state would be essentially the fiduciary of the resources on behalf of the people. There was much discussion. You remember Nebraska senator was one of the guys who held out. Eisenhower himself held out. And they had to be convinced that we could develop resources in a very small population in a very large territory. Essentially, the amount of property given to or the state of California, 110,000 million acres for California, 405 million acres for the state of Alaska. So we had to develop the resources. But it didn't take longer than 10 to 15 years before the federal government started to renege on the agreement that it would be Congress that decided, not federal agencies to the most part, on whether or not we could develop. And when Cook Inlet actually had a native tribe in Cook Inlet, had the first oil strike and so forth, everyone, you know, was happy, but they were still getting used to the idea of being a state. We've got 50 years on that now. By now, as a 50-year-old person, you know, we're expected to be a little bit more mature than when we were little kids. Our dialogues need to be that much more mature, and I think there's a lot more discussion going on. But we are not to the point where we have decided to develop our resources to benefit communities. We still have the mentality, Republican or Democrat, that maximum benefit, as Tom had mentioned, has to accrue as revenue to the state to be doled out by the administration or legislators as they see fit. That's not the right concept. The concept was to, and you read our state constitution, especially Article 8, and you see how they wanted us to develop self-supporting communities, develop the resources, encourage the settlement of the land, encourage conservation, maximum use of the people, maximum benefit of the people, not of the state. If we go back to that, it won't take us 20 years to permit a mine that takes 18 months in the lower 48, and we still will do it conscientiously. Our mining has been proven to that. It won't take 20 years to build a road. Heck, we haven't had a new road built actually in Alaska for decades.
They're building we could connect six right community. Outside this building.
What's that?
They're building six right outside this building.
Well, that's not connecting communities. But we need to connect our communities. We have 250 communities that have airports but not roads.
Okay.
There's got to be a better way to deliver goods and services so that, as Representative Guttenberg said, we can get the cost down to where it's affordable to live.
Dave, Dan issued a list of things that both sides agree on. A, do you agree with his list? And B, what do you think both sides actually agree on?
Well, we might agree on things that we want to do. How we get there is very different. You know, Senate Bill 21, the ballot initiative right now in front of us, that Doug was talking about, the constitutional requirement in Section 8 for the maximum benefit for the people of Alaska. I think this is a reliving of the statehood compact and the arguments then. Who controls the resources? We both want more oil in the pipeline. Senate Bill 21 simply rewards the industry for being in place. It gives them tax breaks for just being there. ACEs, the previous version, which Democrats and Sarah Palin supported together, rewarded more oil in the pipeline. The industry is in the problem that we call basin control. The big producers are doing what they want to do. If they want to do something else, they will get the state to fund it, and that's what Senate Bill 21 does. It pays them to doing the maintenance and the upkeep and the operations that they that any normal, prudent operator should be doing. You know, and this administration clearly has stated that they don't believe in taxes, and the royalties and the severance taxes that the state gets from the pipeline are a significant part of how we build the state. Because at statehood, it was timber, it was fish, it was furs, and the Seattle Chamber of Commerce controlled Alaska. And if the state of Alaska was going to be able to sustain itself as a state, then it needed the resources that it had, and they didn't even know about oil and gas back then. Then we should be the ones that managing for the state of Alaska for those to be able to sustain it. I mean, in 50 years when the oil and gas is gone, where's the money going to be able to build roads, the new schools? And there's a new road being built in my district out of Nenana out west into the gas fields. But with Senate Bill 21, we are a deep deficit spending. The governor promised 1 million barrels into the pipeline, an increase of about 60% or 40%. That's not going to happen. Nobody predicts that. Nobody sees that. But the problem is how we get to the same place, a sustainable state, a state that provides for the children and provides for the future, has good schools, had good roads, has a good economy that's sustaining. When the oil and gas is gone, we've lost our bank account.
Well, we're both delighted that you agreed to be with us tonight. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Another of the popular segments that Ken has done on these roadshow tours, that when we've been in Orlando or Washington, D.C. or Columbus, Ohio, St. Louis, has been the scuttle button that he's done as a feature on his website for many years. Ken, I think you got some scuttle button puzzles for us.
So basically, you take one word per button. And by the way, I told you the website, you could find these puzzles. There's a new puzzle every week at krpoliticaljunkie.com. But anyway, so here's the obvious one. You have Huey Newton of the Black Panthers. You have Thomas Dewey, the Republican nominee for president in 1944 and 1948. And you have Louis Lefkowitz, who ran for mayor of New York City in 1961.
Controller of the state for many years.
That's correct. State Attorney General. Yeah. State Attorney General. So if you add one, you get Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Okay, so you got the theme there? Okay. You have Bob Dole, the 1996 Republican nominee for president. You have Bob Barr, the former congressman from Georgia. Robert Wagner. Wait.
Oh, take my hand.
You have Bob Barr. That's right. See, that was a song Okay. You have Edward Markey, who's now a senator from Massachusetts. He has a seat that John Kerry used to have. Dew Burns was the first African-American mayor of Baltimore. And you don't have a happy face. You have a frown face. So therefore, you have... Oh, where are you now? Yes. big shots. You have the Marquis du Sad. Sad,
yeah.
Very sad. Okay,
you need to whip the crowd, Ken.
That's right. You have the historic peace mission between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat of Egypt from 1977. You have a Lyndon Johnson button from 1964. Let us continue. And you have Al D'Amato, the senator from New York. You have Begin, lettuce, and D'Amato. The sandwich in the lower 48. The good news is that both Doug and David are booing together, so you know there's hope for this country. Okay, you have Feinstein for vice president, you have Perot for president, and on the bottom you have impeach Earl Warren and an anti-Robert Bork button. So, of course, you know, there's something in common between impeach Earl Warren and Robert Bork, but the first one, Feinstein for vice president, Perot for president, and the two guys on the bottom, you have Diane Ross and the Supremes. You have a very great slogan. You know, Carter Mondale was a Democratic ticket in 76, so they came up with this great slogan, Carter Mondale 76. Then you have Strom Thurmond gets the job done. He had a child at 90, so I guess he did get the job done. And this is a very grotesque button, but I got it from the DNC. It says, I danced on Bush's grave. Not endorsing it, but anyway, November 3rd, 1992. So you have the Carter Mondale, you have Strom Thurmond gets the job done, and you have I danced on Bush's grave. You have 76 Strom Bones.
They didn't join the big parade.
Now you know why they canceled Talk of the Nation. I mean, I used to hold the buttons up to the microphone. No, we got it. You have the governor of Texas, Bill Clements, dressed as a chicken. What happened, he was at a fundraiser. He threw a rubber chicken at his opponent in 1978. You have Bill Clements dressed as a chicken. You have Ed Koch, who was later mayor of New York. You have a button with the letter A from the Anarchist Party. The thought of anarchists having a party is kind of ridiculous. And then you have, does everybody recognize the woman on the bottom?
Chicken Cacciatore.
Margaret Thatcher, you have Chicken Cacciatore.
Very good.
Margaret Thatcher, You have two mayors from Jersey City, and then you have a button that says, overthrow the government. Coochie, coochie, coo. And that's it. they applauding because that's it? Or?
I think so. We wanted to take a look at national politics through Alaskan lenses, so we're going to ask our panel of journalists to rejoin us on stage. That's Alexandra Gutierrez of APRN, Dermot Cole of the Alaska Dispatch News, and Tom Hewitt, the opinion editor of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Thanks all for coming back. Wanted to ask you, some of the issues that are so resonant now in the lower 48, how do they play out here? How do you see those issues? For example, big story this week about the immigration issue on the southern border, the tens of thousands of unaccompanied minors who've come up to this country for various reasons, what to do about them, who's responsible, who's to blame, what, if anything, can be done. Alexander, how does this play out in Alaska?
Well, given that the only border we share is Canada, I can't say it quite resonates as much as it might in Texas, Arizona, New Mexico. The only real rumblings I've heard from any politicians about immigration this week is Joe Miller attacking Treadwell and Sullivan for supporting some level of, he says they support amnesty, they say they don't support amnesty. But I mean, when it comes to immigration in the state, what's funny is when you look at our congressional delegation, most of, you know, the stances they've taken have been, hey, let's get, you know, the J-1 visa program, which is basically a student visa that's been used to bring in fish processors in the state. Let's make that more open to people so we can get people working here. So it can be kind of strange looking at it kind of a bizarro lens. Some issues resonate, especially issues related to guns, land usage. That stuff resonates, but then other stuff, sometimes it can feel like we are in a different place, given that we refer to the rest of the country as outside.
Outside.
I do think Dermot? I think that immigration issue will be a big item in the Senate Republican campaign. Over the next month or so. But I don't believe the passions run deep here the way they would in the Southwest.
I think that, you know, in terms of border issues, you know, a more significant border issue to most Alaskans is, you know, the ex-migration of Yukon River King Salmon, you know, making it up all the way up to Canada and, you know, hoping that they do so. So, I mean, that's about the level of our involvement with border politics here.
I mean, I think every state probably thinks, well, we're different than other states, but in Alaska and Hawaii in particular, you know, we are removed.
But I wanted to ask, as Dermot mentioned, Alexandra, now Alaska gets all of the Fox News channels and the MSNBCs and the CNNs that they didn't get not so long ago.
I mean, absolutely. And I definitely think that our politics have become more nationalized, but then there are certain policy issues that simply don't resonate as much. Anything involving health care, which is something that tends to affect people across the country in sort of the same measures, that's going to resonate. But people are getting their news from all of the major cable networks, from public radio occasionally. And I think that, you know, part of it is you look at Washington and it's been the same story for years now where a bill will pass through the Republican House. A bill won't even get heard in the Democratic Senate. It'll get filibustered instead. So it seems that there's definitely the same level of frustration with the federal government and in some ways manifested in kind of a unique way out here. But as far as which issues sort of, you know, get people going, it can definitely be a little bit.
You know, one other thing, some of this is seasonal too, because this time of year, there's not a great deal of, you know, internal focus on TV news, really.
Well,
I mean, you know, again, it's probably more than it used to be. It wasn't that long ago. Well, it was that long ago, actually, that the evening news was flown up from Seattle every night, you know, physically flown up. But anyway, in the summertime, things sort of slack off a bit, which is another challenge for the candidates, by the way.
You know, when you guys watch, as we all do when we watch Washington, we know that there's some code written somewhere that Democrats and Republicans are not allowed to talk to each other because if they do, they get bombarded with a primary challenge from the left or the right. But then we also see situations in Alaska where Don Young may not vote with the Republicans all the time. Lisa Murkowski has shown tremendous independence. Mark Begich has shown independence. Is that part of the independent spirit of Alaska, or are there partisans in the state who wish that Begich was more of an Obama follower, or Murkowski was more of a true Republican as opposed to a rhino, which he has been accused of in the past?
Certainly there's people, you know, to the respective sides of our various representatives in Washington who, you know, would like to see them, you know, vote more with the party. But I think that in general, I mean, more than half of Alaska's registered voters are registered either nonpartisan or undeclared. So, I mean, there is a strong independent streak, you know, here within the state, and I think our politicians at some level know they have to respect that, and also that the good of the state does transcend party identity. And oftentimes, I mean, that sounds like a silly thing that a politician would say, but I mean, oftentimes it is the case that we're out there fighting for our own interests in terms of, you know, things like the bypass mail program, where almost all the other states think that that's something that should absolutely be scrapped. But here, you know, it's the only thing that's keeping mail service to Bush communities from making, you know, a head of lettuce cost $20. Things like that are things that they come together on. And they also tend to, what's funny is there's a little bit of a non-contiguous United States block of us and Hawaii. And there was always a good friendship, as I'm sure you guys know, between Senator Inouye and Senator Stevens.
He campaigned for Ted Stevens, which is pretty remarkable, right?
Yeah, we tend to have each other's back because we know what it's like to be so far away.
Let me ask you something. We have enormous tensions in the South and East China Sea between China and its neighbors. You have Iraq apparently melting down. You have Afghanistan. The presidential election is going up in smoke. The Israelis and the Palestinians are bombing each other to smithereens, and there's no end in sight to that. You have the crisis in Africa. What foreign policy issues, if any, do Alaskans pay attention to? Do they care about?
I think it's given the large military presence we have in the state, if you have a connection to the military, you're absolutely following this. And when it comes to oil and gas as well, our state revenue is dependent on what's happening with oil prices on the global scene. We've always heard the Russia from our house jokes, which this will be the thing that I will absolutely defend Sarah Palin on. That was Tina Fey, so for the record.
Right.
Anyone who makes that joke. You know, sometimes we can feel far removed from everything, but there are ripple effects when it comes to war, when it comes to the global economy that matter to us. And you were talking about East Asia as well. You know, it's always been the big dream to build a gas line and export that product to Asia. When it comes to our fishing industry, so much of our product goes there as well. You know, whether people are interested in it on a day-to-day, that's, you know, up to them, as Dermot was talking about. Sometimes people are a little bit more disengaged in the summer, but I don't think that it's far from people's minds.
I think we're in favor generally, as a majority of the population, of military spending. A lot of supporters are military spending.
A lot of the spending comes here.
Maybe spending is what we like. We like to spend. I mean, it's
we
not
like
so
when
much
it comes here.
It's not so much about the strategy.
As long as it's spent here, yes.
Yeah, there's a great deal of support for that, yes. I mean, when the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan began, it was a really, there was a lot of people stationed at Fort Wainwright in particular that went to war over and over again. And so it wasn't a big issue in the community. But the military population here tends to, young people, they come in and they're gone within a few years. So they're not the voters that stay here year after year.
Also,
so voting
on military bases here is just, I mean, tremendously poor. It's, you know, in the vicinity of 1% turnout. And so although, you know, military issues are at the forefront of people's minds here because of the impact they have economically on the community, the military folks themselves don't usually turn out in numbers such that they are, you know, a big block in state elections.
Well, Alexander, you mentioned Sarah Palin. I know everybody in the audience doesn't want to talk about Sarah Palin, but what I'm fascinated about her the most is that when she was picked as running mate in 2008, she, I think, had the highest approval ratings of any governor in the country. They were 70% plus. Aside from the national notoriety, where did Sarah Palin go from fighting the good fight, fighting the big boys, and becoming a caricature?
Well, it's sort of funny. I was driving through Wasilla a couple weeks ago, where she's from, and I definitely saw a McCain Palin sign in a free stuff pile. I actually am probably the person on this panel who's been in Alaska the least. I was in D.C. when that happened, but I'll let you guys, I can give you my impressions from when I was in D.C.
Too fast and too far. too fast and too far. And she was the most popular politician because when oil prices spiked, she and the legislature gave people a bunch of cash.
Yeah,
well, and that's the essential.
I think the circumstances in which she came to power factored into her popularity. I mean, she was coming after Frank Murkowski, who was one of the most unpopular, if not the most unpopular, governor that Alaska has ever seen. And she was swept in as this sort of reformist candidate in a lot of people's minds.
She was basically a moderate. She didn't run on abortion. She didn't run on same-sex marriage. I mean, those were not the kind of issues she cared about.
Right. I mean, she basically went from being a state politician to a national politician, and it's hard to be a national politician as governor.
But, Tom, let me ask you, when the race broke down for U.S. Senate with Begich winning, it looked like it was a script written for Sarah Palin had she wanted to come back and campaign hard for that seat.
Yes and no. I think that once she kind of had a taste of that national political scene, I mean, the kind of the day-to-day realities of governing weren't really her bag anymore. And she had, I mean, which I think, I mean, in a way it's understandable because when you're a candidate, I mean, you have a lot of freedom to do what you want and say what you want and kind of set the agenda. Whereas, you know, when she came back to Alaska, I mean, there's a lot of kind of local politics that you still have to do, and it's hard, and you have to be on the ground there every day. And
it's hard to go rogue in that environment.
Right. You can't. I mean, Alaska has a very, very strong governor's seat, but it's not so strong that you can just act unilaterally, and that's hard when you have become accustomed to basically saying what's always on your mind and you know, getting your way a lot.
Before we let you go again, I wanted to ask you about one ballot measure we neglected to bring up in the previous panel. And that is in the week after Washington State opened its first recreational marijuana shops. That's going to be on the ballot here in Alaska come November. How does that split? Because you've got some interesting. It's not a left-right issue.
No, it's not a left-right issue, and, you know, people talk about Alaska's libertarian streak. The Republican Party did come out against it at their convention, but it was one of two issues that there was serious debate over when it came to policy. The other was getting rid of sort of anti-gay language from their platform. And you had a quarter of the people there say, we don't really want to come out and support this resolution. And there are members of that party who are now working and helping the campaign it's got like the longest name ever, Campaign to Regulate Marijuana Like Alcohol. I think Triclimna is if you say the acronym.
Somebody thought that was a really good idea at 2 o'clock in the morning.
But I mean, marijuana has, there have been marijuana initiatives in the past. There was one in 2000 that had an amnesty provision with some restitution component that failed 60-40. Then they came back without that component in 2004, and they closed the gap by 10 points. So now we're a decade later. Colorado's tried it. Washington's tried it. There is an opposition movement in the state, but a lot of the news coming out of Washington, Colorado has been largely neutral to positive.
You think of it as a Republican conservative state. This was Ralph Nader's best state. He got 10% of the vote in 2000. This was Ross Perot's second best state in 1992. He got 28%. When you think of independence, I mean, of course, there's the Alaska Independence Party, but is there any appetite for another? I mean, we always talk about if only a third party would be formed, but it never works because you don't have the money, you don't have the infrastructure. But Alaska being so independent, you had Walter Hickel elected as a third party. Is a third party movement in Alaska viable?
Hickel got elected because it was a three-way race.
Right.
Anybody can get elected in a three-way race, and that's how Jay Hammond got elected. We've had most governors have been elected in three-way contests.
But very few governors around the country are elected as third party. I mean, think of Nader and you think of Perot and you think of these strong anti-Democrat and Republican numbers.
We've had numerous people who decide the voters really want them, so they have to run. And that's made these three-way races. That's how Tony Knowles got elected.
I think the key is, too, that Alaska has a very, very strong populist streak. And, you know, that was essentially one of the things that Sarah Palin, you know, cruised to extremely
it's
high.
It's contrarian, really. Whatever it is, I'm against it.
And yeah.
That's it.
I mean, And that's what, you know, why you saw Ross Perot having such strong support here, because, you know, he kind of offered a kind of a populist voice that people didn't see in the other parties.
Yeah. And when I think that if you look at the viability of third parties in the state, you would have to look at the legislature, and we simply do not have any third party candidates in our state legislature. You know, it's 17,500 people for district approximately. You would think that there could be a third party candidate who campaigns hard, seems to have the support of the community, who maybe came up through local government. But we haven't seen that happen.
Or a hedge fund.
And we hardly see any of these third-party candidates run for the legislature. I mean, we've got one Libertarian and one Constitution Party candidate right now. And then 58 seats that don't have a third-party candidate.
Well, thank you all again. We do appreciate your time and your observations on both Alaskan and national politics. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alexandra Gutierrez, Dermot Cole, and Tom Hewitt. Ken, as difficult as the 2014 Senate campaign looks for Democrats, where they're defending many more seats than the Republicans.
21-14, right.
And a lot of people are now predicting that Republicans have a very good chance of taking over the United States
Maybe.
Senate. We'll see come November. In any case, 2016, it looks just as tough for the Republicans.
Well, the thing is, of course, obviously, every Senate term is up every 6 years, and in 2016... the class of 2010, that big Tea Party, anti-Obama class, is up for re-election in 2016. So even if Mitch McConnell does become majority leader in 2014, and there's a chance he could. I mean, again, the Republicans will take West Virginia, Montana, South Dakota, maybe Louisiana, maybe Arkansas, maybe Alaska.
Maybe North Carolina.
North Carolina. And then you have some blue states that are possibilities, like Colorado. That's going to be a tough race. But again, look, what's so silly about predicting in 2016, the day of the New Hampshire primary in 2008, Barack Obama, who won the Iowa caucuses just a week or so before, we were predicting everybody would say that Barack Obama wins, and Hillary Clinton did win New Hampshire a week or 10 days later. So the point is, don't listen to anything I have to say ever. The point is, we have no business predicting, but the numbers, at least if you look at the numbers in 2016, it looks good for Democrats, but who knows what Obama's numbers are going to be in 2016. You know, we could think of, well, I mean, if only Chris Christie would run. Yeah, right. I mean, once upon a time, Chris Christie was a guy who was going to be the Republican savior.
Talk about a bridge to nowhere.
Exactly, right. And Jeb Bush, but I mean, if we see the battles, the same kind of battles over immigration and amnesty, as one of the panelists talked about, if Ted Cruz runs, if Rand Paul runs, and he fights with fellow Republicans about foreign policy, theoretically, you could say Clinton, all she has to do is sit back, you know, give $300,000 speeches, mm-hmm. and waltz to the presidency. But stranger things have happened. So
I was going to say, in 2008, at this time, people said the prohibitive favorite to win the Democratic nomination was Hillary Clinton.
But it was states like Alaska that where Barack Obama outworked her and out-organized her, in states like Idaho, Alaska, small caucus states, that whereas Hillary Clinton was putting in tons of money in the big states, Obama, where the delegates mattered, where the delegate counting was going on,
so
he just out-hustled her.
Is somebody like Howard Dean sitting there with Elizabeth Warren saying, if you outwork her, you can win this thing?
Well, look, anything is possible, and we've been wrong before, and I kind of like when we're wrong before, because, no, I do, because...
Well, at least we're consistent.
But we also, I like to be surprised. I mean, sometimes, whatever you think about Eric Cantor, and did he lose because of immigration? Did he lose because he was measuring the drapes for the majority leaders, the Speaker's office? Nobody saw it coming, and that's what's the beauty of politics. It's not pollsters, it's not the pundits, it's the people. Yeah. But I mean, that's what we love about going to the states around the country and talking to people like you, because you're the ones who decide what's going to happen. It's easy for people in Washington to say, well, Begich is a Democrat, he's pro-Obama, and he's in big, big trouble. But the Republicans have their schisms in Alaska and states elsewhere, too. So what's great about you is you make your decision. It's up to you, and don't let people tell you to decide. Don't look at polls. Don't look at, you know, anything like that. Decide for yourself.
The only thing that we can tell you with good confidence is that this conversation will be continuing in 2016. So I hope you'll have us back. Conan and Rudin in 2016.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you all for coming. Drive home safely.
You've been great. I really appreciate it. Thank you.